The armored wagon at the front of the convoy was the only one to have a clear path ahead of it. Those in its wake were forever driving into a cloud of dust. Zarir, the silent driver of the armored wagon, was, however, even more diligent than those who followed him. He was gripped by a paranoia that riders would come out of nowhere and attempt to outrun him. Armand Laguerre didn't give a shit. As long as Zarir drove fast and true, that was good. As long as he stayed silent, it was even better. The rest of the trade crew were garrulous, and there was a time when Laguerre welcomed that. Hell, he even looked for it. And he was still cool with it as long as it was kept to the other wags. But since he'd taken Eula on board, he wanted some silence in his wag. The girl was quiet and didn't react well to noise, conversation, or questions, especially the latter. So the chance to get rid of Cody, a talkative bastard at the best of times, into the next wag had been more than welcome. At the girl's request, the man Dix had replaced Cody instead of riding shotgun in the second wag. Laguerre was confused by that. Okay, so Eula had really wanted to take the newbies aboard. In truth, it had been more her idea to stop for them than his, and she was adamant that she wanted Dix to travel with them. But Cody was a tech man, not a sec fighter. Second wag was safest, but even so. Laguerre did not argue with Eula. He hadn't argued with her since the moment she had joined them. She had found them a little over 18 months earlier, searching him out in a ville called Evermore, on the eastern fringes of the Central Badlands. He was in a gaudy house, busy enjoying himself with three gaudies, two of whom were putting on a show, while the third made use of the pleasure he was showing at their performance. Eula had walked in as if she owned the place, asking him if he was Laguerre and where he was headed. Most times, if someone did that to him, he would have blown the person's head off. But there was something about this one, the way she completely ignored the surroundings, not from embarrassment, but because she was too focused to notice. There was a kind of calm menace about her. When he asked her why him, she had replied that he was a traitor, he was about to leave, and she needed to get away quickly. His first thought was that she had pissed off Baron Chandler, head of Evermore, and taking her on would lead to a firefight with the Baron Sec. She had to have sensed that, because she was quick to tell him that her problem was with another vill. She had already traveled 100 clicks, but she knew she was being followed, and she needed the cover of a convoy to hide her tracks. It would have sounded like bullshit, and dangerous at that, if he'd heard it from anyone else. But from her, it was different. It was the way she spoke, the way she carried herself, the serious hardware that was draped around her in a way that wasn't usual for anyone, let alone a young woman who looked barely old enough to handle a blaster. Like all good traders, Laguerre had a nose for a good deal. He may not have been the best trader, but he was better than a lot. She had that air of a rare stash about her. She was something a bit special, and could lead him to a higher level. It got his sense of greed tingling. So, he agreed to take her on. Laguerre just sat and watched. Watched the two of them sit, stand, walk around the interior of the wag, and say nothing to each other, even though the very air around them crackled with tension. Eula had been insistent that Dix travel with them, and for his part, the skinny guy with the glasses and hat had seemed pleased by that. Laguerre couldn't make him out. When he said that he didn't know her, he seemed to be on the level. Yet the way he kept looking at her from the corner of his eye, the way the few words he said were guarded, almost to the point of being cryptic, the body language as he stiffened and pulled back every time she got close, all of that suggested that he had suspicions of where they may have met. Laguerre would love to know that. She had never enlarged on her initial statement to him. A vill about 100 clicks from Evermore going east. It could have been any number of vills. Part of the area to the east was fucked, completely uninhabited. Okay, scratch that. Maybe there were a few settlements in the contaminated area, but they weren't anywhere he or any other trader particularly cared to go. That still left a number of small vills ruled by desperado barons. Not many traders cared to go there, either. Not much jack, not much to barter. So Laguerre didn't know squat about any of them. If she was telling him the truth, bitch was too self-contained and sure of herself to do anything else, then it had to have been one of those. He'd moved on quickly, and hadn't been back that way in the year and a half since she joined, so there hadn't been the chance to check out her story. But he knew one thing. The only trader to really make use of those areas had been Trader himself. The man was legend. He'd got richer than anyone, had more of a stash than anyone, done more business than anyone, because he'd worked harder. Yeah, and where had it got him? Sometimes you just had to kick back a little and enjoy the fruits of your labors. If this guy Dix had ridden with Trader, along with the one-eyed guy, then he had to have been to some of those vills in the east. Probably the one that Eula came from, the one where she had gotten into some trouble and had to run. So maybe Dix knew her secret. And given that she had wanted to search those guys out, and was interested more in him than in any of the others, maybe she knew his. While this had been going through Laguerre's head, Eula had been guiding JB through the armory and associated tech held by the convoy. She had explained to him in few words the condition of the armory when she had joined, and the steps she had taken to both improve the quality of what was there and to add to the inventory, making them stronger. Each weapon she detailed at length, telling him things he already knew, but seeming to tell him these things for a reason. For the life of him, JB could not work out what the code behind her words may be. She was demonstrating her knowledge to impress him, but why? Why would she want to impress a man she claimed to know, but who had no recollection of her? Eula was in the middle of showing him the comtech that she had managed to get up and running after they salvaged it from some ruined ex-military wags, carefully avoiding an explanation of how they had come to be wrecked, he noted, when JB decided that he could take no more.
You're good. And I want to know where you learned all this, especially so young. Took me years on the road with Trader to amass the kind of knowledge you've got. Had some before I joined, but it was only hitting the road and finding shit that helped it build. You must have grown up with someone who knew this stuff.
I did.
So, who taught you?
In time, John Barrymore. In time. I don't give anything away for free. That'll have to wait. You need to do some thinking. Think about this, John Barrymore. Remember a place called Hollow Star?
JB's face stayed impassive, but his mind jolted. Yeah, he remembered Hollow Star. The past. It took a month, no more, for JB to settle into Trader's way of life, to stop being the new kid, and to start being just JB. Such was his skill and knowledge, given room to grow by the ordnance that Trader's people collected on the way, that he became more than that new guy, the Armorer, but became known as the Armorer, just as Trader was Trader. They were the definitive article, their positions used as names, spoken as though there were none other than they, fit to carry such a name. Not that it came easily. Poet knew how good the kid was from the beginning. After all, he was the one who had been sent to look at JB, assess his skills, then fake the work to test them. Hunniker was hostile. She was always hostile to anything new. A loyal and trusted fighter, with a ruthless streak a mile wide, who could always be trusted in times of battle, yet she had a spiky, difficult temperament in her. She was insecure of her position in the convoy, which she prized highly. She measured herself by her standing with Trader, as the convoy was the only family she had, and despite her seeming ability to act and live independently of anyone or anything, there was a little hollow inside of her that craved the familiar security of the convoy. Everything revolved around that, and when it changed, then she bristled and lashed out. It was a dangerous way to live, especially on a convoy where every day brought the chance for someone to buy the farm, and change was an unspoken constant, which perhaps explained why there were days when all everyone wanted to do, even Trader, was stay the hell out of Hun's way. And she kind of liked it that way. It gave her status in the convoy. Except that JB walked in and acted like that was nothing. He didn't challenge her. That she could take, she could face down, she could do something about. No, he did something far worse. He ignored her. He acted like her moods didn't happen, like there weren't days that people edged around her rather than get into a fight. He just didn't notice. So she loathed him for some time. It became a subject of discussion among the convoy, and the subject of a gambling book run by Poet on how long until they had a fight, and who would win. Virtually everyone put Jack on it, even Trader, and it was a keenly awaited event. Given Hunt's temperament, and the taciturn and phlegmatic new man, it was only a matter of time. And not much of that. That was, until the day that JB saved Hunniker's life.
Motherfucker!
Trader and his group were up north, where the temperatures dropped, and any potential combat had to be undertaken with the added encumbrance of furs and padded clothing. Movement was difficult, threw off timing. Worse, it led to weapons screwing up in the extremes of temperature. They had been caught in an ambush, and one of the wags had been temporarily disabled. The group was crouched behind their wags, taking cover.
All right, I've had enough of this shit!
Hunniker dashed out from behind cover and began to charge up the ridge from which the ambushers were firing.
Fuck you!
As Hunniker made her way up the hill, she got more and more pissed, the anger building in her until it reached the point where she could see nothing but red mist. She was cold and she was aching because the rocks were battering her through the padding and the furs every time she took evasive action. Pun in a real fighting anger was both a good and a bad thing. Good because she became a killing machine, stopping at nothing. Bad for the very same reason. She paid no heed to danger and rushed headlong into it.
I'm gonna kill me some fools!
The ascent was hard, but she didn't care once the anger took hold. Blinding rage, blotting out every other feeling, every other concern. She didn't even register that she had reached the top of the ridge, had picked her way along to the enclave where the bunch of cold hearts this side of the pass had ensconced themselves, didn't even register as she raised the Uzi, sighted the bastards, squeezed on the trigger.
Well, fuck me sideways!
She realized that her luck had run out. Knowing there was no time to take cover, there was none on top of the ridge anyway, she closed her eyes and prepared to buy the farm. Hun realized that she was still alive and opened her eyes to see the armorer standing over the bodies of the cold hearts, the barrel of his mini-Uzi still smoking as he stepped over them and came to her.
Cold and heat make the fuckers jam. Need to keep them so that the temperature is as constant as possible. Under your coat when you climb next time, okay?
JB didn't say anything else, taking the Uzi from her and checking it as he spoke, then handing it back to her. The battle was intense. The traitor's group managed to escape the fight without casualty. The armorer never said anything to anyone about what had happened up on the ridge. Hun certainly wasn't going to, if he wasn't, and she appreciated that he made no big deal of it. No one knew why, but from that day, all bets were off. It wasn't as though there was any sign of friendship, but the bristling atmosphere that she had exuded every time she was near JB vanished. There was a respect, grudging at first, then growing into a mutual admiration society that had bets being returned, much to poet's disgust. Time went on, and everyone in the crew watched as JB and Hunniker got each other's backs in situations of danger. Trader had made many finds over the years that he could call good, but he was coming to consider that one of the best hadn't been in finding any goods or jack, but in finding a man. John Barrymore Dix. So it was that the armorer settled in, became a fixture such that no one could remember a time before he was there. But it was only a year. Only a year before Trader returned to Hollowstar.
Why are we going to this dead and alive pest hole?
Warwag 1 rumbled along a rut-filled highway, the convoy the only vehicles on a four-lane road that headed away from the muddy growth of trees, creepers, and plants that thrived in the chem-laden rains of the region, and toward a sparser, clearer region where the bleached out and burned remains of civilization showed how the nuke damage stood as monument to Skydark.
Because it is.
And that's an answer? More like a fucking puzzle.
You work it out, son. It isn't difficult.
Abe, Trader's right-hand man, explained it to JB, seeing the young man's still puzzled expression.
Boy, how'd you think you hooked up with us? How many convoys had come through that pest hole you found yourself in, huh? Not many, I'd guess. But Trader, see, he pays attention to detail. There are little places like Guthrie, like Hollowstar and the lands beyond, where there are people who want to buy. They got something to sell, too. I mean, it might not be much, but if you go only once a year or so, then it makes the trip worthwhile for us. And they're desperate for what we've got. They're willing to pay, because no one else can be bothered.
In the year that he'd been with them, they had headed for the big settlements, the larger villes, the areas where there was a large population. And they'd made good trade, that was for sure. But always with other traders there, just before, just after. People whining about how little they'd gotten, or how much they were going to get. It figured that if there were places that were hard to get to, then few would bother. Except Trader. JB had been with him more than long enough to know that attention to detail was what made him the best. So he wasn't alarmed when Hun took Warwag 1 off the highway at a turnoff that led to a place called New Jersey, according to the sign that hung precariously over the narrower ribbon of road. The vibration of the convoy on the ruined road made the metal posts supporting the sign shake, the once strong metal now wasted and eaten by the environment, looking as though it could crash down on any of the wags in train.
Always looks that way. Puts people off, but never comes down. Leastways, not yet.
Why not stick to the main roadway? Looks safer.
Everyone comes this way the first time thinks that. Hell, even got caught that way ourselves first time out.
Oh, man. You should have heard the cursing when we had to turn back. Only found this turnoff because Trader was so stubborn he didn't want a totally wasted journey.
You carry on down the highway. All you get is it ending in a big fuck-off landslide, or part of the old county got a hit. Must have been some kind of quake thing going on. As you can see, nothing but this big empty hole for what seems like forever. The other side is... shit, I don't know, but I bet not much can live over there. So like Abe said, we were all pissed, not just me. Anyway, as we came back, I saw this road and thought, fuck it, nothing's gonna be alive in this bastard region. But then it occurred to me that every fucker must think like that. For the sake of a few gallons of fuel, why not have a look-see? We had enough spare with us.
And there, at the end of the line, was Hollow's Star. A poor little place, but managing to get by because of where it was.
It must be triple stoop, because I don't get that.
Of course you don't. No one does till they've been there. I sure as shit didn't.
And you won't hear him say that often.
Ah, fuck you. See, there were a few survivors in this region, but the vills they made could only exist if they put them on a road that survived. Well, the big fucker didn't, but their smaller one did. They used to call it the New Jersey Turnpike, or so they say around here. There are a few vills, some places too small to call that, and they ribbon out along the road until it just kind of ends. Hollow Star is the richest, Baron Everton the smartest, and lucky.
Why lucky?
Whoever built Hollow Star used buildings around the old toll booths for the road, and they still work. To pass through on either side, you have to pay the Baron. The smart thing is that whoever started the bill wasn't greedy, so in the long run, they've had a steady stream of jack coming in both ways. There aren't many who pass through, but they have to pay in and out, so that's two for one. It isn't much compared to vills out there where there are more folks, but that's the word, isn't it? Compared. Makes Emerton and all those who came before him richer and more powerful than any other baron in the region. Smart boy.
Honecker, who had so far been ignoring the conversation, chipped in.
You do realize that every poor fucker who joins us and lasts this long gets exactly the same speech when we come here. Almost word for word. I know the fucking thing by heart. I swear. I could say it in my fucking sleep. Probably do for all I know.
Ah, fuck you, bitch. Next time I'll make you say it just to see.
Yeah, well, we'll see about that. Meantime, you should all stop yakking as we're there.
JB looked out of an op port. The foliage that had covered the side of the old highway had now thinned out and changed. The vines and creepers had vanished, replaced by sparse grass under trees that were still twisted and stunted in places, but had a healthier look than the looming green giants that lined the highway. The remains of some old buildings could be seen, low-level blocks that had once been shops and warehouses, but were now split by trees that had grown through and broken the line of the structure. There were no houses in this section. If there had been, they had long since been swallowed by nature, reclaiming its damaged stock. The road they were now on had narrowed, and was two-lane gray asphalt shot through with weeds, the sidewalk a similar hue, the weeds now more prevalent in places than the original stone. The way in which Hollow Star sat in the middle of this semi-wilderness was common to many vills J.B. had seen, and so would be the people. They didn't change in essence, no matter where you went. They had different customs and ways that you had to get used to, lest they chill you for insulting them in some manner of which you weren't even aware. But that was just surface. Deep down, they were as brave, scared, greedy, lustful, sharing, good or evil in one place as they were in another. You just had to take them as they come, size them up, and then treat them accordingly. It was a simple way, and one that had kept them alive so far. That put them ahead of the game as far as many were concerned. There were too many who didn't live this way, and had long since bought the farm as a result. These were the thoughts that went through his head every time that he entered somewhere new. It was as if he was preparing himself for whatever he was about to face, reminding himself to keep a close watch until he'd understood the ways of the vill. But this time, it was stronger than he'd ever known it. As if there was something nagging at him. JB didn't believe in that doomy shit. Not unless you were some kind of mutie, which he knew damn sure he wasn't. Nonetheless, as Hun slowed Warwag 1, signaling their approach to the old toll gates, he knew that something was going to happen here that would change things for him. Good or bad. That was the bastard thing. I couldn't tell.
Welcome back to Hollowstar, Trader. How long has it been?
Trader eyed the sweating, grossly fat man in front of him and figured that it had been too long. Baron Emerton was not his favorite Vill leader by a long way, but he was basically harmless.
It's been too long, friend.
Things haven't changed much around here, except that maybe we're running low on some things. We weren't expecting you to be so long, and so we didn't maybe plan so well.
Trader knew only too well what that meant. The cost of going through to the Vills beyond would be higher than last time, with each part of the increase carefully explained and accounted for.
I'm sure we can come to some agreement. I have to say, for my part, I would have been back this way sooner, but we've had a few firefights along the way with parties who wanted to make trouble. You know me, Baron. I don't like trouble. But when it happens, you have to deal with it. Anyway, we lost a few people along the way, picked up some newbies. Things go on, no matter how tough it gets.
I'm sure our Vill will give you ample time to rest before moving on, and I hope that you'll take advantage of our hospitality, both before and after your trip down the road.
Emerton was referring to the one highway that linked the Radblasted East with the lands west of his Vill. It was the convoy's custom to rest a few days on either side of their trip into these lands. It gave the crew a chance to enjoy themselves before they hit the road once more. And more importantly, from Trader's point of view, it meant that his crew spent some Jack in Hollowstar, making Emerton and his Sekmen that bit sweeter when it was time to come around again. Trader left Emerton in his baronial house. The Baron had been flanked by his personal Sekmen, Laker and Farmer. Trader had taken Abe and Poet with him, as they had traveled this way the longest, and so were the most familiar with the sweating Baron.
Whoa, nice to see the Baron's fitness plan is working so well.
Trader almost kept the smirk from his face, but figured what the hell, seeing as they were out in the open. He took the chance to look around the Vill and reflected once more on how, even by the wacko standards of some of the places they'd done business, Hollowstar was a weird one. For a start, despite operating as a toll gate on the road that split the Vill, it had been built some distance from the old toll booths. A brick construction fulfilled their function, built just beyond the last of the houses in the Vill, a scaffolding gantry across the top of the road mounting armed guard. This was completely at odds with the way that the rest of the Vill appeared. If Trader had to take a guess, he would have said that whoever founded the Vill had a definite idea of what they wanted, a show Vill that idealized the way they wanted the country to develop again. The problem being that they had to use what they had, so it turned out kind of wrong. Trader figured that they had chosen here, away from the old toll booths, as those were surrounded by the remains of old industrial and retail areas. This was an empty space of land, and it looked to Trader as though they had painstakingly taken some of the low-level houses in the area and transported them to rebuild here. Others had been built from using salvaged materials, shaped to fit the overall plan with some odd results. Storefronts lined a main square that had a bandstand, although in all the times he had visited here, he had never seen a band in there. And the square was grassed over, if it could be dignified with that term. Trader had seen pictures of how green-lawned squares like this had looked before the new cost. This square achieved that look only if one applied a high degree of imagination. In truth, it was a square of dry dirt, with creeping weeds choking the brown stunted grass that struggled with the toxins in the soil. But still, it had one big asset, and Trader was going to enjoy that asset meeting the Armorer. Yes, indeed. That would be one to watch.
Whatever you want, the answer is no. I'm too busy. I don't have what you want. I don't want to have what you want. I don't care. Just go away.
JB raised an eyebrow at Trader.
Friendly bastard.
You know, the seasons come and go, but some things just stay the same. Luke! Get your ass out here before I take my custom elsewhere!
Elsewhere my ass! No way you're gonna find anywhere else around here that can do what I can.
The owner of the voice wandered into the storefront from a back room.
Still, it's good to see you back, Trader. Always give me good business, and it's nice to hear a voice that doesn't talk about the same small village shit that everyone else never shuts up about.
Yeah, it's good to see you too, Luke. But I'm figuring that you've got some competition that you didn't count on. Meet John Barrymore Dix, my new armorer, and probably the only man I've ever met who could give you a run for your jack.
John?
JB.
Whatever. So you know a bit about blasters, do you? Trader here told you how good you are? pity if he has, as he doesn't know enough to cover his own ass, so he may have sorely misled you.
I don't figure. I was doing the same kind of thing as you do here before I met Trader.
You were, huh?
JB looked around at the storefront. Coffee sub boiled on a stove. There were a couple of tables and chairs in the floor space in front of the counter, and the back room was shielded by a long drape.
Of course, I didn't have to run a coffee stall as well as work on blasters. I was able to devote the whole of my time to the real work.
This is no coffee stall, my friend. This is just for those who wait for me to get my work done. So, Trader, do you have any work for me? Or has Wonderboy here seen to it all?
I've tidied up anything the Trader needs, so maybe he's brought me here so I can help you out.
Ever tried to fit a stock on a Sharps that some damn fool has tried to recalibrate?
Can't say I have. You reboard it?
Got the lathe, just in the middle of it. Care to, give me your expert opinion on what I've done?
I could try.
Luke lifted the flap of the counter, allowing the armorer to pass through. He raised a questioning eyebrow at Trader, who shook his head. Without a word, Luke let the flap drop and followed the armorer into the back room.
Long time since I saw one of those.
JB didn't know what Trader was talking about, and he didn't much care. He had the feeling that they'd lose him after a few minutes anyway. His mission here was done. Get the boys acquainted, get them past their own spiky natures, and when they were ready, get them to look over his ordnance and anything they might pick up on the outbound journey. Christy had long since ceased to pay any attention to what Ray was saying. He was a nice enough old guy, she supposed. But the fact that he never shut up meant that only one word in ten was worth listening to, and after a while you couldn't even summon the energy to try to catch anything. But that was okay, seeing as the old man didn't seem to care whether she was listening. She looked at him, past him, and occasionally shifted on the padded seat to look the other way, at least in a token attempt at surveillance. But the truth was that his voice became kind of hypnotic after a while, and she could feel herself start to glaze over. And that was why she nearly missed it. It was only when he repeated himself that she realized it was something important.
What?
I said there are bandits on the horizon, and ain't it about time someone said something about it? Hellfire, missy, if I can see him, then it's sure as shit that someone else in the convoy will have. This is the problem, see? No one talks to each other anymore, do they?
Christy snapped to attention and looked past the old man, out beyond the road in the dust bowl. They had been driving nonstop for nearly 18 hours at a steady pace, and she was sure that she had to have dropped into some kind of sleep when it was dark. But for the most part, she had been awake. It was now almost the middle of the day after they had joined the convoy, and the sun beating down on the arid land had thrown up that weird heat haze again, limiting the horizon. Which meant that the wags she could see in the distance weren't as distant as she could have hoped. They were low level, obscured by the clouds of dust that they were throwing up in their wake. There were at least six vehicles, maybe more, but hard to tell at this stage, as the formation and the clouds of dust made it hard to distinguish at distance. Christy snatched the comm mic from the unit that rested between herself and Ray.
Enemy approaching from the southwest, maybe six wags. Anyone else seen them yet?
I see them, Christy. Figure we should assume that we can see six, but there may be more in train. It's better to be safe. You and me only have hardware to fight close up. What about the other wags?
Christy thought about that. Why hadn't the others said anything about the incoming? Then it hit her. The other wags may be better equipped, but they were lower. The cabs of the refrigerated wags were raised much higher and rode above the clouds of dust and wag exhaust raised by the convoy. The lower-level wags that came between the trader's lead wag and the refrigerated wags would be enveloped in the clouds they raised. That meant it was up to Mildred and herself to make sure the odds were as level as possible. While this had been running through part of her mind, she had also been surveying the approaching attack party. The convoy had either slowed or the attackers had picked up speed. Whatever the reason, they were now gaining, moving from a diagonal line of approach to a straighter line, aided by the slight bend of the old highway. Even through the clouds of their own dust, it was easy to see that the initial estimate of six, maybe eight, had been too optimistic. There were two rows, one running almost exactly behind the other. 12 wags.
Shit.
They had three armed wags, two men on bikes, and two big cabs that carried a minimum of ordnance.
Doc, JB, you hearing this?
I am indeed, dear girl. I am assuming that we want to eliminate the risk before it becomes too close.
Got that right.
We got cannon fire capacity in this wag. Eula tells me that you got that too, Cody. And it's in your wag, Doc.
Hell yeah! I'm told this is true.
Okay. We haven't heard from Jack or Ryan yet. Figure they can hear us?
No way.
Stoop idea giving them the comm shit. Guys who bought the farm last time told me they couldn't hear us. Just acted according to what they saw.
It was as JB had suspected. Whatever tactics they planned and relayed to each other, they would have to assume that Ryan and Jack would be acting independently. So they'd have to give them space so as not to end up helping them get killed by accident.
We have to keep triple red alert for them. As soon as they see the enemy, they'll head for combat. So we need to hit as hard as we can, and now. Millie, Christy, you've only got ordnance for close-range combat, so it's up to me, Doc, and Cody to knock the bastards out. Lay down a barrage and get their range.
My dear John Barrymore, it'll be a pleasure.
Yeah, let's hope it's that easy.
Doc, you sure you used one of these before?
Raven spoke to Doc as he seated himself behind the rocket launcher that had been mounted and bolted into an odd slit in the wag.
Not this particular model, at least. I think not.
Yeah, that's cool. We let the old guy loose with the honking big piece of hardware that he doesn't know squat about. You see where these jokers are, Rave? Because I can hardly see Ray's ass in front of me.
That ain't a pleasant thought, babe. But yeah, I can see them, and they're about to hit our range.
Doc, studying the rocket launcher and mentally comparing it to previous weapons he had fired, was only too quick to comply.
You are going to like this. Not a lot, but you are going to like it.
A couple of the wags veered, but no damage was done. Doc's face fell.
Oh, heavens, what a waste of ammo. John Barrymore would be fearfully annoyed at such waste. I must endeavor to find my range a little more easily. Like this, perhaps. That one must have been good, John Barrymore!
The clouds of dust and smoke from the approach, hits, and damage of the first rocket assault meant that it was now almost impossible to see how much damage had been caused.
Hold fire! Wait till we can see the bastards!
Indubitably.
Man, speak our language.
Right on, man.
Both Christy and Mildred felt helpless. At this point, there was little that either of them could do. Sealed in the cabs of the refrigerated wags, with little in the way of hardware that would be of use for anything other than the most up-close of combat. And in truth, close fighting with a bunch of cold hearts who outnumbered them was the last thing they wanted. Nonetheless, it seemed to them that they had been reduced to mere spectators, and that wasn't a good feeling. Their trucks were several feet higher than the dust and exhaust cloud that surrounded the lower-level wags of the convoy on the old highway, so they were able to observe the results of the attack with a little more clarity. At first, the attacking party was lost in its own dirt, with the rocket damage adding to the obscuring screen of smoke and dust. But as that began to clear, it revealed localized black columns that bespoke of hits. There were two columns of dissipating smoke from the rocket hits, with craters at their base. Of the 12 wags, three were nothing more than smoking wrecks with their own columns of smoke from the wag fuel that rose high into the air, flames at their base. Another two were entangled together, having crashed into each other during evasive maneuvers to escape the rockets. As the women, in their respective cabs that seemed to be hermetically sealed from the outside world, looked on, the two entangled wags exploded. If the rest of the attack party had still been in the vicinity, then this could have caused further damage. Unfortunately, the initial strike had done nothing more than spur them on. They were bearing down on the convoy with even greater speed.
Five down, John. Seven bearing down.
JB listened to Mildred's words as he squinted through the op-port, trying to make out the lines of the attackers through the backwash of dust that rose from the wheels beneath the port.
Dark night, Laguerre. How the hell do you expect us to mount a defense when you make it this hard to see the enemy? We need to stop and meet them head on.
He looked at the traitor. Laguerre was sweating heavily, his eyes wide with fear.
No way. I only fight when the odds are stacked on us winning. There are too many of their bastards, man. We can't stop, can't slow down. That way lies buying the farm.
Bullshit. We can't see the enemy, we can't hit them, we buy the farm.
Fuck that. I'm traitor here and this is my convoy. Do it my way or not at all.
JB knew that arguing with a terrified man was useless. Especially a terrified man who had power. And especially when there was no time, he cursed to himself and turned back to the op-port. During the few seconds he had been arguing with Laguerre, the dust had cleared a little, and it was easier to see. Maybe it was also easier to see, because the seven wags left were gaining at speed.
Why didn't you say?
Eula had been watching all the while, and it said nothing to alert him.
You're in charge. It's your job, and you're supposed to be good at it.
Within seconds, they would be too close to risk another rocket attack.
Cody, Doc, hold fire on the attackers. Ryan, Jack, what are you doing? Answer, damn it!
Ryan and Jack had been operating almost in isolation since the journey had begun. Their only contact with one another was as they passed by each other on their wreck maneuvers. Even then, it was impossible, because of the heavy protective goggles and the dust, to make anything remotely approaching eye contact. Ryan caught sight of the attackers before Jack. It was inevitable, as the albino youth's sharpest senses were dulled by what was surrounding him. It was at the farthest reach of a patrolling arc that he saw the wags on the horizon, breaking through the shimmering heat haze. Ryan wondered if the convoy had seen them, thought about barking his sighting into the comm mic that was by his cheek, then figured it would be next to useless. He hadn't been able to hear them, didn't even know if the bastard thing was working. There was no sign of the approaching wags being attacked, but there was no way they were in range of any ordnance carried by the convoy. Ryan figured that the best he could do right now was to make Jack aware of the approach, so that both of them would be ready to act.
Jack! Hey, Jack!
But he realized the futility of it. He couldn't hear himself. No way would Jack be able to hear him. He would have to find another way. The two riders had fallen into a pattern, passing each other on a circuit that only their close knowledge of each other, an almost telepathic empathy built up among all the companions by their times of standing shoulder to shoulder in combat, would enable them to execute without fear of collision. Ryan changed his pattern, taking two circuits to fall in beside Jack. The albino teen had been perplexed by Ryan's change, though no sign of this had crossed his impassive, scarred visage. Not wanting to second-guess the one-eyed man, Jack had stayed in his circuit, operating as a holding pattern for Ryan to orbit until his own new pattern had been established. Once Ryan was riding parallel to Jack, the two men looked across at each other. Ryan raised one hand, pointing in the direction of the attackers and signaling Jack to follow him. With Jack in train, Ryan led them out of the wake of the convoy. The new circuit, taking them beyond the lip of the old highway and into clearer air, where it was easy to see the approaching wags. Turning, so they now ran at an angle to the rear of the convoy and keeping a line that enabled them to wreck the attackers, they saw the first rocket from Doc miss its mark, followed, to their gratification, by JB Strike. The two riders stayed their hand until the smoke and dust had cleared enough for them to be able to fully assess the situation. Seven wags were left running and closing on the convoy so fast that it wouldn't be long before the long-distance weapons would be too dangerous to the convoy itself at such a shortened range. There were no other strikes, and the convoy kept moving at its current pace. What the hell was going on? Both riders knew that JB's tactics would be to bring the convoy to a halt. Sure, it made them a sitting duck rather than a moving target, but chances were that this was a raid for Jack and supplies, not a drive-by for sport. In which case, direct hits weren't in the opposition's game plan. It was a risk, but the armorer played the odds. From a standing position, they could be far more effective as a strike force while defending ground, so JB would have the convoy stop. Yet still it rolled on, neither increasing nor slackening pace. It had to be Laguerre. Both Ryan and Jack had marked the traitor as a slippery, tricky bastard, but neither one had thought he could be a stoop or a coward. He was either or both. Unable to communicate with anyone else, or even each other in anything more than the most rudimentary terms, the two riders knew that they would have to take action, without recourse to JB or any other companions. They would just have to trust that they would be seen and not be the victims of friendly fire. The attackers were closing fast. Ryan indicated to Jack that they should move out. Jack nodded and followed his lead, as Ryan guided the bike onto a course that would take them in to engage with the enemy. Going through both riders' minds was the fact that the seven wags hadn't yet fired a single shot. It was reasonable to assume that this was because they needed to be closer to engage, and the only logical reason for that was that their ordnance could only be used up close. Handguns, short-range SMGs or rifles, Grens maybe, but only propelled manually or through attachments to the shorter-range hardware. If it was a reasonable assessment of what they would face, then they knew that to keep moving and fast would make them hard to pick off while the attackers were also on the move. It was a fighting chance, and that's all that Jack or Ryan would ever ask, especially as they were now close enough to have come within range of this assumed ordnance. The primary aim was to prevent the oncoming attackers from engaging the convoy. Because of the limited ordnance that Jack and Ryan carried, they knew that their best course of action would be to separate the seven wags in the attack. If they could pull apart any formation that the attackers had, then it would be easier for the moving convoy weapons to pick them off. The off-road ground was smoother than the shattered highway for a short distance, as the old shoulder of the road had remained flattened and hard-packed. But beyond this, the ground became treacherous. Ridges of dirt and rock, holes caused by burrowing rodents, patches of dirt that clogged and covered potholes, and cracks in the surface area. All of these could be easily negotiated on foot and wouldn't cause anyone to stumble. But driven over at speed by the tires on a bike, these small contusions in the earth suddenly became traps that could maim or kill. So both riders opted to zigzag, trying at the same time to keep up as much speed as possible while avoiding the worst of the uneven ground. It was a far from ideal situation. Unable to communicate by sign anymore, each rider had to hope that the other would know by some kind of instinct where the other sat. Their heads were filled with the roar of the bikes and the rush of blood that accompanied each bone-shaking jolt. Their vision was obscured by the dust that swirled around them and the dirt and flies that gathered on their goggles. The oncoming wags would be fixed in the center of their vision, only to be shot out of the side or the top by a jolt that caused the stomach to try to force its way through the craw. Handguns were all that Jack and Ryan had, and to try to grip and fire while riding one-handed was asking to be thrown. Nonetheless, it was all they could do. None of the return fire seemed to hit. The bikes didn't buck and rear from tire or engine damage, and there was no searing pain or numbing sensation from a slug ripping home. In truth, it was hard to know what was going on. In the middle of this engagement, it was impossible to know if their tactics were working or if circumstance had diverted them. The true pattern could only be seen from the outside. JB was watching the maneuver with mounting apprehension. He would have much preferred to bring the convoy to a halt, adopt a defensive formation, and then bring the attackers into an area where the armament he carried could blast the living hell out of them. But Laguerre had scuppered any chance of that. JB knew that Ryan and Jack would expect him to do this, and wondered if part of their pulling away from the convoy was to act as bait to the attackers, drawing them into an attack that didn't exist. The convoy hadn't deviated from its path. It followed the line of the highway, as simple as that. The attacking wags had come from a diagonal, deviating only when the rocket attack had put paid to nearly half their number. They had pulled an almost 180-degree turn and seemed to be going back on themselves. Their aim soon became clear. They were moving to cut ahead of the convoy. Instead of coming from the side and risking another blast from the rocket launchers, they had opted to cut back to try to meet the road so that they could turn and meet the convoy head-on. And now Ryan and Jack were entering the fray, leaving their posts at the rear and heading across at another angle to cut in front. JB figured that he knew what they would do if they could. Divide the enemy, make it easy for convoy weapons to pick them off. No way they could do much damage themselves. Looking at the way they were ducking and weaving across the dust bowl, he doubted very much if they would be able to risk any shots of their own. And they had no communication. He couldn't raise them, and so he was damn sure that they couldn't raise each other. So friendly fire was a real and present danger.
Dark night!
Seven wags, none of which looked that heavily armed. It should have been piss easy. Instead, he was watching Ryan and Jack on their erratic course, wondering how the hell he could fire on the attacking wags without taking out the riders. One thing for sure, whether they knew it or not, Ryan and Jack were serving the convoy well. Their sudden appearance and the path they were carving across the land meant that the attacking wags had been forced to modify their course, both to meet the new threat with attack and also to avoid a collision that would have suited neither party. Now, instead of running a course that would see them hit the road ahead of the convoy, they had been diverted into one that saw them running parallel to the highway, the bikes running interference between them. The seven wags were currently devoting their attention to the bikes. The riders had avoided being hit thus far, but it was only a matter of time before probability dictated such a hit. The good thing for the convoy was that fire was being taken away from them. Without their attention being taken up by the need to respond, it gave JB vital seconds to plan and act, rather than being forced to react.
Cody, Doc, listen carefully. We can't talk to the bikes, and they can't talk to us. I want to avoid hitting them. But the truth is, we can't tell what Jack and Ryan are going to do. They're keeping the wags from firing on us, but that won't last long. We got SMG capability, and we're going to use that and not the rocket launchers. I want each of you to pick a target area and stick to it. Don't try to follow the wags. Just aim at those that come in at a 100-degree angle. Make that the firing area.
Okay. You're the boss.
My dear boy, I completely agree. Spare the rod and pass the ammo, I say.
A fleeting grin crossed JB's face. He had no idea what the hell Doc was talking about, much like usual, but he knew that he could rely on the old man.
Okay. Pick your targets and fire at will.
There was no further dialogue between the convoy wags. JD settled in behind the SMG post to fire at the attacking wags. The burst came from the second-in-line wag in the convoy and ripped into a clearing space between Ryan and Jack, hitting home and causing one of the attack wags to spin off course, a plume of smoke rising from a gas tank that had caught fire. The wag veered erratically away from its companions, the crew jumping to avoid being consumed by a fire that spread rapidly. Their flight was in vain.
Good shooting, Cody.
As JD spoke, he took aim for a wag that had come into his field of vision. It drew level with Laguerre's armored wag, then used its lighter weight and comparatively stronger horsepower to pull ahead, starting to alter course so that it was moving out of parallel and into an orbit that would take it in front of them. Jack and Ryan were farther back, engaged in weaving between the five wags that still moved straight.
Nice try, but no way.
If they thought such ordnance would have an effect on the wag, they were soon disabused of the notion. JD knew it was now time to see what else they carried with them. If it was heavy and could cause damage, then he didn't want to see it, so he had to act swiftly. The attack wag was pulling forward and across, making an angle of fire from the leading wag more and more difficult to attain with accuracy. If they could pull out and come straight onto Laguerre's wag, they would hit a blind spot. There was a cannon mounted for firing ahead, but the Honorer knew from its design that it was a long-distance weapon. Sighting it for close-in firing would be difficult, if not impossible. Further, if the attack wag was heavily armed, then blowing the bastard out of the road could lead to damage from the blast. The narrow window of time that he had available to him was closing rapidly. JB switched to the rocket launcher, using the sighting device to try to get a closer look at the wag. It was far from perfect. The imaging was intended for heat-seeking, and so it was like trying to unscramble a diffused negative picture. There was a mounted SMG and something else that looked like an adaptive Gren launcher, maybe a mortar of some kind. Whatever it was a piece of hardware that could do them some damage if the men in the wag decided to use it. JD couldn't give them that opportunity. They were pulling ahead quickly, their wag engine obviously tuned to a finer degree than many JD had seen. The heavy trader's wag was fast, but the attack vehicle was lighter in construction and carrying much less weight. JD's mind raced as he made the mental calculation to allow for that. He had to get the shot right. The sighting equipment was for heat-seeking, but he didn't want to rely on it and then find it wasn't in full working order. He threw it by eye alone. He trusted himself with nothing else.
Dark night. That wave must have been carrying some serious shit to cause a wave like that.
Excellent shot, my dear John Barrymore. But may I suggest that we attend to the remaining vehicles? I fear our friends are running out of time.
JD turned his attention to the battle that was running parallel. The bikes were still weaving, but as they got closer to the five wags, their attempts to draw them out and apart seemed to be doing the opposite. The lines proscribed by their pads seemed to do little more than ensnare them. The dirt around their wheels, pocked by gunfire, came closer and closer to taking them out. So while it was imperative that the convoy take out the wags first, the very proximity of the bikes made this a harder task than at any other point.
Doc, Cody, we got no choices here. Keep firing like before, but keep the blast tight. Short bursts only, and be triple careful.
Shit, man. If the wags blow, then they could blast those guys right off the bikes.
I know, but we got no other option. They're being drawn in too close.
It is as Ryan would want it. Young Jack, too.
Jack stared at a toothless attacker who was standing behind his mounted SMG in a semi-crouch as he tried to swing the long barrel around to bring it to bear on the albino.
Aw, shit!
The burst had come from Doc's wag.
Not shooting, you old fucker!
Jack didn't see the result of the shot. Instead, with a finely honed instinct of a hunter sensing a weakness in his prey, he pulled away a fraction, using just the one hand to guide the bike, while the other leveled the Colt Python at the head of the wag driver. Jack's attention was diverted, the need to focus on keeping the bike upright, meaning that he missed the aftermath of his action. Veering wildly as the dead driver's grip loosed on one side, marginally before the other, the wag careened into the side of another wag that was pulling ahead. Catching the rear end, it caused the second wag to go into a spin. As it spun, it clipped the underneath of the first wag, which had tilted up into a flip at the impact. The wags became entangled as the underneath of each chassis became exposed. Jack threw his bike into a turn that took it away from the fireball, throttle opening wide to outrun the wave of heat and fire that threatened to engulf him. Somehow, and he wasn't sure how, the dirt beneath him hit a harder, more densely packed patch, allowing his tires to grip as the front wheel hit a surface again. The bike picked up speed, and he felt the heat recede at his back.
By the three Kennedys, the lad's a marvel.
Doc watched Jack escape by something less than the skin of his teeth. Doc had been convinced that the albino was dead meat, even given his remarkable skills.
Truly, whatever may govern this universe is looking down upon him on this day.
Doc, honey, stop yakking and fire the fucking thing!
No, of course, my dear, you are quite correct.
JB smiled and nodded his head. The two wags crashing together had left just the three to contend with. Further, the way in which they had collided and then blown had caused the remaining vehicles to scatter, breaking formation to escape the worst of the fireball. The enemy scattered, separated, and was much easier to pick off. It was almost a bonus that Ryan and Jack were now distanced enough not to impede their compatriots' lines of fire.
Cody, Doc, one each, guys. Let's take the bastards out once and for all.
A pleasure. Sure thing.
It was like shooting fish in a barrel, and Doc loved every second of it.
Try this one on for size.
Woo! Way to go, Sugar! Good shooting!
Doc allowed himself a shrug.
One tries.
Meanwhile, Cody's wag of choice had come within range, and the marksman in the second convoy wag hit a long burst on the SMG that ripped along the side of the attacker's wag, puncturing the bodywork and the bodies of the inhabitants with equal impunity. The wag careened across the dirt-packed land before the spilling fuel and the sparking metal detonated all within. One remained in JB's area, and just right for him. Ryan was ahead of it, drawing it in toward the convoy as it chased him, SMG fire ripping up around his wheels. The guys in the wag were consumed by fury and bloodlust, not thinking about what they were doing. That just made it easier. JB held his fire until Ryan had passed through his sights. And then it was over. Almost anticlimactic. The convoy rolled on. Sarir, almost seeming not to have noticed the mayhem that had just occurred. The other wags followed in his wake, unable or unwilling to slow. Ryan and Jack fell in at the rear, unable to communicate with the others, waiting for such time as Laguerre decreed a rest stop before being able to ask questions about what had occurred and why. They were exhausted, but forced to continue. JB looked at Laguerre. The traitor seemed unconcerned by what had just happened. The armorer looked at Eula. The young woman regarded him impassively, as though the events of the firefight had not occurred, as though she were examining him in minute detail, trying to get inside his head, unconcerned by what had just happened. JB's sense of unease welled up with renewed vigor. There was something odd about the whole situation, something that could spell danger not just for him, but for all the companions. Something for which only he could find an answer. If he could figure out what the question was. The past.
I've got to hand it to you, traitor. I don't know where you got that boy from, but him and Luke are like blood brothers. I'm feared that when one leaves, the other will want to follow. And we really couldn't have that. Unless, of course, your boy wants to stay. Now that may be a different matter entirely.
Baron Emerton's grin was broad, but didn't reach as far as his eyes. Beady, dark, and glittering, they were sizing up Trader's reaction. The grizzled veteran of too many psychological games wasn't likely to fall for anyone as blatant as Emerton. The man was a fat fool, and a dangerous one because of the power he had, but a fool nonetheless.
I don't think you got too many worries there, Emerton. Luke wouldn't leave this place. Can you see him doing anything but moan about having to move his tools, pack and unpack all the time? And JB, wow, JB's just JB. Boy likes to keep on the move, and it isn't my business to ask why.
So there's no chance you try and filch Luke?
Luke's one of the best, maybe even the best. You know that as well as I do. But he's not the traveling type, and I've got an armorer who can match him. Leastways, that's how I see it. And the thing he has over Luke for me is that he wants to travel, doesn't want to settle down. In fact, he'd have a shit fit if I even so much as suggested a thing. And when that boy goes, well, he's quiet. But when those type go, they go in a big way. I've seen some scary shit, Emerton. But I'd rather face that than JB when he's really pissed.
Trader had chosen his words with care. To a casual outsider, he may have seemed to have been overstating the case. Would a traitor heading a convoy really let his armorer, a subordinate, behave in such a way? Not if he was going to stay a leader for any length of time. In truth, Trader would no more have stood for such behavior than he would for being shortchanged in a deal. But he was more than willing to exaggerate, if it would get his point across to the Baron, who sat gross and sweating in front of him. It was the worst part of having to use Hollow Star. To make the tolls worthwhile on the way through, it was best to try to do some trade with the Baron and his people, which in terms of goods and Jack was passable. Hollow Star was far from rich, but its position meant that there was always something to be picked up from the tolls imposed on those who had passed before. And it had Luke. The ordnance expert was legend in this part of the country, and before he had recruited JB, it had been the chance to use Luke's skills that had added to the appeal. But the downside was that Emerton always insisted on entertaining his guests. Trader had a pretty strong stomach in many ways, but Emerton's idea of entertainment was enough to make you puke, in more ways than one. First, you had to sit through the banquet. 7 courses of meat, sweet meat, and rich sweets. A buffet of sickening, decadent extravagance. But that was nothing compared to the other way in which the Fat Baron's banquet could turn your gut. Emerton was obsessed with young women. It was something the trader knew, disliked, but preferred to ignore in the greater interest of survival and trade. Trouble was, Emerton had no shame about his depraved taste and thought nothing of flaunting it. So it was that the food was served to them by scantily dressed, very young servant girls. It was sickening. Emerton kept returning to the subject of JB and Luke. He was a sly bastard at the best of times. The way he was talking about it, hunting around the edge of the subject, trying to sound out Trader's own views all the time before voicing his own, it was hard for Trader to know whether the fat man was worried about Luke wanting to join Trader because of the way he and JB had bonded, or whether he wanted to snatch JB from Trader and join the two of them together as a product that could be exploited for greater gain. Either way, the Baron had noticed how close the two men had become, and although it hadn't really entered Trader's mind up to this point, he began to dwell on it as he and Abe made their way back to the convoy, dismissed by the sec man after the Baron had passed out from drinking too much. Trader had become used to having the quiet man around, and with the skills JB had forged for himself, an invaluable place in the convoy. He'd be more than missed. On the other hand, they hadn't seen that much of him for the few days they'd been in Hollow Star. In Luke, he'd found a kindred spirit. Maybe the Vale would appeal to a man who had never put down roots. Not everyone was a natural nomad like Trader and the majority of his crew. He'd assumed that JB was one of them in that respect. What if he was wrong?